Flashback Twin Cities, Tom Osmond here on the icy Saturday morning. It's not Snowmageddon this year. It's the Polar Vortex 2014.
Well, what I think you're forgetting is that we've had about four Snowmageddons so far, at least in this little area.
Yeah, Snowmageddon is very 2011. This is 2014.
So passe.
We've had Halloween blizzards, we've had Snowmageddons, we've had... You know what we do have, though, coming up this week? Newsapalooza.
Oh, I knew you were going there.
Evening of History and Humor at the Heights Theater. If you've not gotten your tickets yet, go to tcmedianow.brownpapertickets.com. That is one of many plugs I will make today for that event.
If you go to your Facebook page as well.
My Facebook page, the KLEB Facebook page.
Yep. What's your Facebook page?
TC Media Now.
There you go.
Or tcmedianow.com. It's going to be a fun night. Our friend Stan Turner, the host of the All Request Noon Lunch Hour, will be there as part of our media panel, as will Rob Lear and Brian Lambert, yours truly, co-hosting with Jack Stallman. We have lots of clips prepared. Some clips we might have heard on the air, and some ones we might have been saving for a night just like this.
I'm really excited to hear Brian Lambert in a situation like that. That guy is fun.
He might have a few opinions. He's been known to have an opinion or two. I might have had an opinion or two. But if you're tired of being cooped up in the house because of the weather that's trying to kill us, come on out Thursday night. Doors open at 7 o'clock. Show starts at 7:30. It's going to be fun. Tom, you'll be there. I'll be
Absolutely.
There.
Absolutely.
And, I mean, right there should sell at least 100 tickets with all of us being there.
I mean, I'm not going to be too humble about this. I'm kind of a big draw.
No, let's not be humble. We've been cooped up all too long. I go to Paul Douglas's blog on the Star Tribune when I need to get some weather insight. And I'm sure you've heard this. We just don't remember what winter was like because we've been so soft. We've had some light winters, some warm winters. We haven't experienced winter like this in our lifetime. I beg to differ. This is an email that Paul Douglas received from Pete Boulay of the Minnesota Climatology Working Group, and it's quoted as of yesterday, this is on Thursday, the Twin Cities are at 10 degrees for the mean temperature of the winter, a tie for the ninth coldest winter since 1978-1979. That would mean, in our lifetime, we have not experienced winters like this.
So this is abnormal.
It is abnormal. And, also on the blog, 24 inches of snow on the ground in the Twin Cities. The most snow since late January 1982. Tom, were you around in that period?
In 82?
Yeah.
I was not.
Okay.
I was it was close, but not quite.
Well, the people in the studio were. But,
Yeah, you were barely around. Well, you got me beat, sure.
This is a quote from Paul Douglas, a whopping 38 inches on the ground in 1982. And Pete Boulay, Minnesota Climatology Working Group, writes, 24 inches or more has only happened in 8 other years in the Twin Cities. The last time was on January 26, 1982. The record is 38 inches on January 23, 1982. One of the few records the Halloween storm did not break was the deepest snowfall on the Halloween blizzard was 23 inches. So, if you got keeping track of inches, this is the place to go. Go to Paul Douglas's blog and... prove to your friends that, no, this is a miserable winter, and we're not just, not used to them.
Well, if you subscribe to the law of averages, last year was pretty darn mild. It lasted a long time, but it was not terribly cold.
I remember winter lasting till like 4th of July last year.
Yeah, that was pretty much right on. But it was kind of that weird ground where you couldn't go in a t-shirt, but it was kind of too warm for a sweatshirt.
Nah. 26 years ago, in 1987, winter didn't really happen. And people were complaining about it. So I have some audio here I want to play. This
sure.
is a forecast from February 20th, 1987.
And now the latest installment of the wacky winter of 87.
Boy, it is.
Starring Dave Dahl.
And you hit it right on the head yesterday, Stan, when you said that winter up here in the upper Midwest is a spectator sport this year. That's all it's been. We're watching winter go around us, and we're watching it again tonight. Especially in the Southwest, they've had lots of snow. Amarillo, Texas is the latest installment to our watching the weather. There it is. They've had a lot, as much as 4 to 6 inches already fell. That caused a lot of traffic problems. Traveling is very difficult to treacherous down the southwestern corner of the country. They expect a surge of more snow, maybe 4 to 6 inches, by later on tonight. They do have a winter storm warning across the Texas Panhandle from there into northeastern New Mexico, southern Colorado. Heavy snow warning up to a foot or a foot and a half could fall in the northern mountains of Colorado. And then lesser amounts of snow wrap around that.
Winter in Texas and not Minnesota that year.
I could deal with that.
I could deal with that.
At least I feel like I'd probably be right there with everyone else complaining if it didn't happen. What happened to Minnesota?
You know, we have fans on the Facebook page from all across the country, and there's a couple of people in Dallas that were complaining about the 40-degree temperatures they had this year. And I think we had one day over 40, and we were all fooled again.
I remember that day because people were running around in short shorts.
Yeah, you wait
like
till
that's Minnesota right there.
45. We have a guest today. We have Doug Stone, and Doug Stone was a former. What was your role to start? You can help me out here.
Afternoon, Tom. I was a reporter at the Star Tribune. I was there 10 years. Last 6 or 7, I was a legal affairs reporter. So trials, Minnesota Supreme Court, U.S. Federal Court.
Nine years of WCCO TV.
Exactly.
2 years in Washington.
Yes.
16 years in McAllister.
That's it.
And beyond. We're going to go to break here. We'll come back with Doug Stone. Doug has a very interesting and very diverse career of both print and electronic media. And so we have a lot of questions for Doug. And we'll come back after this break on Flashback Twin Cities here on KLBB. Flashback Twin Cities, Tom Osmond with my guest, Doug Stone. Doug, welcome back to Flashback Twin Cities for the first time to Flashback Twin Cities.
Thanks for having me, Tom. It's a pleasure.
We were talking off air just a moment ago about the media's reporting of weather. And, I mean, we're the media, and we're talking about it. We've talked about it every week because we need something to talk about sometimes. But it's interesting. There's a fine line, I think, between are we reporting actual news? Is weather news? Or is weather just something to fill the time with? And when it's raining, can we bump into programming and tell everyone it's raining?
Well, it is a fine line, and particularly on television. I think, you know, television stations have determined through research and what have you that people, at least in this market, watch weather. They're interested in the weather.
Mm-hmm.
Farmers are interested in the weather. Parents are interested in the weather, where school is going to close. And this has been an unusual winter. On the other hand, you know, there's so little time in a newscast, and if you give – say you have a 13-minute hole, I don't know what it is these days, but, you know, if you give 5 minutes to weather, that's 8 minutes for everything else, or the rest of the news, or if you have a 20-minute hole, it's a big chunk of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you have to make a determination that we got to cover it when it's a big story, but we don't have to dwell on it constantly every newscast.
I asked Paul Douglas once this question. I said, when you break into weather and you have the sleeves rolled up because you're looking at the Doppler radar, are you sweating? Are you getting really anxious about the weather? And I was joking with him about that. But I like when you see the reports when they have the sleeves rolled up and they're like in the war room looking at the Doppler radar to tell us that it's going to rain of a windstorm. I'm not sure if Paul appreciated that joke or not, but I did have to ask him that. You know, this year, you can't watch TV without the crawls now. And the crawls, which I think 30 years ago used to be a slight crawl with the beeping, and now it's a very graphic interface. You're watching a TV program if you do watch
a lot of work goes
TV.
Into those.
A lot of work goes into it. There's flashing lights, which county you're in. It can be a little bit frightening. And if you aren't desensitized like we are, I can understand where people might get alerted. I think that people actually are, you know, now that the weather reports and warnings are so background now that everything is a warning, everything is an advisory, that when things are actually in imminent danger to us, we're not paying as close attention.
I think that's true. I think you can numb people to the seriousness of weather. And we have had a serious winter. We've had, you know, a lot of people die. We've had, you know, you mentioned the cold and the snow. We've had six school days closed. I don't remember that happening in my lifetime.
No.
In one season.
Right.
And I'm not one of these that say, well, we were tougher back then and we didn't. That's not what I'm saying. I think they were legitimate closings.
Mm-hmm.
I wish we had something. There's got to be something between what we do and what they do in Hawaii, which is they don't really have a weatherman at all. The news guy, at least this is what I recall when I was out there, the news guys report the weather because it's always 70 and sunny unless they have a storm coming.
Oh, they have those kind of problems, right?
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Well, I remember I was listening to Jeff Peterson, our morning host, and he was discussing how years ago there was a blizzard. No one had expected it to happen. And all the weather people said, it's gonna pass by. It's not worthy noting anything like that. When it came in, it struck hard, really hard. People died because of it. And from that point on, they made basically a statement. If there's any chance at all that this could be something worthwhile, we're just going to tell everybody. So now, like you were just saying, it's just warnings all the time. Everything is a warning.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough to get perspective on it. And, you know, when the weather people, when they lead the newscast with the weather people and then they go right to the radar pictures and all that, I think that confuses people.
Yeah.
I would rather see, if you're going to talk about the weather, let's see the pictures of it. I mean, they do show that eventually. But the weather person standing at the chroma keyboard, you know, with the maps and the storm moving, you know, they do, the National Weather Service has that. When we talk about hurricanes, and it's kind of interesting because it kind of shows where you go. But a lot of times the weather graphics that we show, they're interesting, but they're kind of confusing.
When you were the assistant news director at CCO-TV, did you have any direct input on how weather was reported, how weather was presented in the news program?
Well, to this extent that we would have our planning meetings in the morning and in the afternoon, and if weather was a lead, you know, we'd toss it to the weather people and the producers that decide, you know, how much time to give it. And, you know, on the news side, we would figure out how to cover it, how many crews to put on it, how many reporters to put on it.
Mm-hmm.
Weather is a big deal in television, and I don't mean to diminish its importance. I can't remember which storm it was, but my old friend Tom Ziegler, who was my colleague on the assignment desk at CCO back in the 80s, we had a terrible storm. And a lot of people couldn't even make it in. And he walked to work. I think he lived in Brooklyn Center. And he walked to work. And I think there's video of him the last couple blocks or something. It's an amazing thing.
Oh, there's a story for you right there.
That's impressive.
It was in the 80s. I can't tell you which year.
We were all tougher
storm.
Back then. I mean, it was probably winter of 82,
definitely.
Probably. The you went from print journalism to TV journalism. Let's talk about the print world. Did you go to school, journalism school? Did you want to be a investigative reporter? Did you want to do the traditional that traditional route?
Yes, I did. I graduated from the University of Minnesota. I spent all my days at university when I wasn't in class working at the Minnesota Daily. I covered all kinds of stories there, administration. I covered the legislature when I was a freshman. I'd go over there three or four times a week. I always wanted, and I had an internship at the St. Paul Dispatch one summer, and then two summers at the old Minneapolis Tribune. So now it's the Star Tribune. And then I got hired right out of college, which would never happen today.
No, there's a lot of people in this town that you know, some of them had to go to the Reader before they went to the Star Tribune, but there's very few chances now even going through any of our TV stations or of our two papers. Well, eventually be one paper probably, but to be able to go right from journalism school into a job that you can feed yourself with.
Yeah, and I think I was joking with some old Star Tribune colleagues. I think my first year, I got a letter from the managing editor said I would be making $114 a week, which seemed like this would be 71. It seemed like a lot of money for a single guy. And
hope you had a nice car. Yeah, hope you went and bought a nice car. And
I don't know what I did with it, but it doesn't seem like a lot now, does it?
It was kind of a blur back then.
What? So did you do local stories then, too? You did legislature, you did the city council. Is that where your
beat
was?
The legislature I did when I was in college. At the Star Tribune, I was general assignment, and then I was a police reporter for two or three years, which meant you had the best hours at the paper. You worked Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday from 3 to midnight.
Do you have a police scanner in your house?
Not in my house, but they had one at the newsroom. And when I left the police beat, I trained in R.T. Ryback, my friend and colleague, the former mayor. Or once in future mayor, I don't know what his political plans are, but he was he learned the police beat. He always tells people, and I don't know if this is true or not, but he always tells people when we run into each other that I trained him as a reporter. But he did a great job in politics my help.
Yeah, you know, people don't remember, he wrote for the paper for what, 10 years?
He was at the paper for 10 years? And I think he also worked at the Reader as a publisher, maybe?
I think he was the managing editor, I think, of the Reader at one point. That's in, I think, what, Nick Coleman was in his early days before he was columnist. Was that the?
Oh, yeah. We had a great staff back then of young people. It was RT was there. I was there. I'm not saying I wasn't the great, but.
You can.
Mike Gelfand.
That's right. Or M. Howard, as
M.
he was
Howard,
known in those days.
I call him Mike. A guy named Terry Farrell. And then there were some people who were veterans there already, like Peg Meyer, Dean Ribafoni, Steve Dornfeld. I still see those guys. They're buddies of mine.
A lot of young ambition in that era, I'm guessing. And then you made that transition to TV. And did, at that point, did print journalists think the TV journalist was a little bit, was it lower? Was it not, didn't have quite the pristine as the Star Tribune did at that point?
Most print journalists thought that, including myself to a certain extent. And most people weren't quite sure why I was making that transition. I got the job at CCO because my old friend and colleague Dave Nimmer had made the transition from the Minneapolis Star, where he was the managing editor and before that a great reporter, over to CCO as a reporter. And I have to go back and tell the story. His first, Dave's first TV report, with shot by the late Gordy Bartouche, was about, I know it was a weather story, but it was about some kind of plowing snow or something. And Gordy shot, Nimmer's a short guy, and he shot him in front of this gigantic snow pile. You've seen him around town, like at Midway Stadium, over there where they dump the snow. And he looked like, you know, an ant compared to the snow pile. And, you know, I called him and I said, you know, it was a good story, Dave, but, you know, they shouldn't accentuate your shortness by putting you in front of this gigantic snow pile. He said, you, well, I won't say what Nimmer said, but then he laughed.
The visual consciousness of TV is, as they say, right?
Exactly. Anyway, the transition from newspapers to TV, so most of my colleagues couldn't understand what I was doing, but I thought it would be a good experience.
Was this due to the merger of the Tribune and the Star, or was this just something that you just wanted to do?
It was something that Nimmer suggested to the news director at the time, Reed Johnson, and then I guess to Handberg, that, you know, maybe I'd be, they wanted to have a news person, you know, on the assignment desk, someone, you know, who had good contacts, not that they didn't at CCO already, but, you know, whatever. And I just thought it'd be a good experience, you know. And I enjoyed my time at CCO. It was great.
Well, 9 years. But our guest today, Doug Stone, and he just talking about his days at the Tribune and then also at CCO TV. Was it a little bit of a – was it any kind of – was it somewhat boring? You come back from – you're a beat reporter. You're on the streets. And now you're back at CCO TV, and you're at the desk right now. You're managing paper, your contacts. Was it boring, or were you like, this is actually just fine by me? I can go home in the afternoon. And
well, it wasn't boring, Tom. It was different, because I wasn't out on the street, and I missed that part, because being a reporter is a really exciting job. I don't know if I could do it now. I'm in, you know, my mid-60s. It seems like it'd be more challenging to be hustling like that. But in my 30s...
Hey, Sid's 95. He's still doing it.
That's true, yes. Sid's unusual, though.
It's true.
But I wasn't bored. First of all, I had a lot to learn. I had to meet a lot of new people. I had to think about the news in a different way. Because when you're a newspaper reporter, you get... Well, in those days, it's different now, of course, with the internet. But, you know, you go out, you interview people, you cover things, you call people on the phone, with typewriters, eventually computers. You know, you write it up. In television, you've got to think about, you know, well, what's going to make a good visual? You know, is this person going to go on camera? And then do we have enough crews to send here, the crew being the photographer and then the reporter who goes with him or her? Who's best for this story? And you have limited resources, because at the paper you have, you know, dozens of reporters. When I went to CCO, you know, on a given day we might have 8 reporters and 8 or 10 photographers.
And you do need a photographer. You need an audio person.
Not an audio person. The networks used to, we basically had a photographer who did the audio, and then the reporter who helped him.
And I think CCO TV is one of the few union shops still open in the metro area. I think right now a lot of stations in Minneapolis, even around the country, you are not only the reporter, you're also carrying around your own camera and uploading your story to the internet, you know, at that moment. So it's a very different world.
It is.
Even 10 years ago.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, and newspaper reporting is different. I mean, they not only have to file a story for the paper, for the newspaper, but they have to file something for the internet, for the web, and many of them take pictures. Some of them, and they do videos now. So it's more like being a wire service reporter in the old days, where you're constantly filing things and being on top. It's a much different game now than it was.
You know, and I assume you're still a news consumer. You know, looking at what's, you know, how things are being reported and what things are coming up. Do you find it as amazing as I do that the speed which information comes from what happens to people read it and see it? Do you find that interesting? I do. I see that these stories evolve, and someone blasts a headline out there or blasts a blurb out there. There's a crisis or there's someone has made an announcement. Whereas when you were assignment editor or even the paper, it'd be till the next day before someone would actually get that printed paper out their front doorstep.
Do you mean like a tweet? A tweet coming out right away?
Like a tweet, or even if you're on WCCO or KHTP, they put it on their website, and hopefully people will tune into their news program that night. But what do you think about that?
Well, the world has changed. It's dramatically changed even in the last 5 years. And I sometimes tell people, or my journalism students when I was teaching at McAllister a little bit, you know, my kids sometimes hear about a news event, even though I'm a news consumer, but they'll hear about a news event before I do on Twitter or Facebook. But the difference is they don't have any context. They hear something happens, but they don't really know what it means, and they don't necessarily care that much about what it means. Whereas as an older consumer of news, I want to know, you know, how does that fit into this and who said what and all those kinds of things. And that kind of comes from my newspaper and then television background. It's a different age, though, and we have to kind of make it. I think the biggest challenge for news people is to not let the technology drive what's good journalism. And sometimes that happens. And you know, you have to use the technology, but you still have to make news decisions. What's a good story? You know, how much time or space or room on the internet should I devote to this? You still have to make ethical judgments about what's right and wrong. You still have to be aggressive. And you can't let, you know, the ability to do a lot of things, whether it's to go live or to have pretty graphics on television or to run a video on your website, you can't let that dictate the way you make decisions.
Well, not only the technology, but also the competition. If we look at right now compared to, let's say, the mid-'80s, there's about three prominent national cable networks. There is this thing called the Wide World Web, which anyone can post anything, and then it can be declared as news, whether it be a blog or it be a news site, which is mostly just someone's opinion. Do you think facts are looser now? Do you think facts come after the fact, and it's what sounds good right now, get someone's attention, then work backwards?
Well, I think we're challenged by making sure we get the facts right because it is moving so fast. And anyone, as you said, can post something on the internet, whether it's on your Facebook page, and then that becomes gospel. And sometimes it's not checked out as thoroughly as it should. And even really credible, you know, news organizations, the New York Times or the Star Tribune, will, in their rush to get something on, maybe make a mistake on their internet version of the story. And then you'll see that, you know, if they're responsible, they'll correct it. But I think we do, you know, I haven't studied this, but I think there's a tendency to make mistakes when you're moving that fast.
Let's talk about your career. You went from WCCO, and then you decided to go to Washington because you went to Senator Paul Wellstone. Did you work on his campaign before he was a senator?
I did not. I left CCO. I was kind of doing some consulting. And then Pat Forcia, a name out of the past, who I had known from my coverage at CCO and his involvement in politics, called and asked if I'd be interested in being interviewed. I went over to the St. Paul office, and I interviewed with John Blackshaw, who was working with Paul, and also I think Paul was there at the time. And or maybe I interviewed John on the phone and Paul was there. I can't remember which, but anyway, between the three of them, you know, they offered me the job. And I went to Washington. It was pretty exciting. I was there for 2 years. Paul Wellstone, of course, was a great guy. High energy.
I can't imagine. I interacted with him one time, and I was a younger person then. He was very intense and very lively.
Yeah, he was intense. He was lively. He was a good human being. He had incredible energy. Comes from his days as a wrestler in high school and college. He was a really decent human being. He had I wouldn't say love-hate, but kind of a love-dislike relationship with the media. On the one hand, reporters loved him because he's very honest.
And he would talk to reporters.
And he would talk to reporters. On the other hand, when I worked for him, he got frustrated because he felt some reporters would try to put him in what he called a frame, you know, a stereotype, if you will. You know, he's just for this or he's just for that or he's a short or whatever. And he didn't like that. So my job, as I saw it, was to kind of represent him to the media and also to explain to him what the media wanted. And, you know, there, we had conflicts, professional conflicts, not personal. Because when I first got there, I spent more time with him than either of us did with our spouse.
Because you have to understand, in order to represent this person, you have to understand this person. You have to understand what's their reaction going to be, what's their hot buttons,
right.
And then what if there's any communication problems, how do we solve those?
Exactly. And I was, a lot of his staff were people who worked on his campaign. Some of them, a lot of them were former students, very devoted to him, very great people, very excellent people. I'm still friends with some of them. But I was kind of an outsider in that, you know, I casually knew Paul, but I'm this reporter who's a little bit suspect, coming to do, you know, communications work for the senator. So, you know, we had our battles, but we always liked each other and respected each other. And when I'd run into him after I left Washington, he was extremely friendly and to me and to my kids. And so,
well, and what, just to give me some context, what era did this happen? Like, what era were you working for? What years?
Well, I went there in right after he was elected. So he was elected in 1990, and then he took office in 91. I went there right when he started in 91. And I worked pretty much to the end of 93. The last couple months of 93, I was back in Minnesota because I was moving back, but I was still working out of St. Paul.
Because he was not – the money was not on Paul Wellstone to win that election. So I oftentimes wonder whether it be Paul Wellstone or not to compare him to apples and apples, but Jesse Ventura. Sometimes the most surprised people in the elections are the people that actually get elected to these positions.
Yeah.
And you have a group of very devoted volunteers and people that spent days and nights, sacrificed their families, and this is your band you go to Washington with, or you go to the governor's mansion with. And, you know, some people, I look at, like, you know, David Ruth, who was a producer, a KFAN, who now is a, you know, was a communications director at the University of Minnesota, I believe, and, you know,
he worked for Jesse, right?
He worked for Jesse, yeah. He was Jesse's producer. And then he followed Jesse to the governor's mansion, and now he's been in high-profile jobs in communication since then. I just find it interesting how, you know, the people you stick around with, you know, it's some career paths can happen.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I'm amazed that the people who I knew from Paul's office, either in Washington or Minnesota, have all, almost to a person, done really well in politics. You know, Danny Kramer and Robert Richmond have their own political consulting group. Kari Moe works for Keith Ellison now. She was a chief of staff at one time for Paul. John Blackshaw's got a good job. On and on and on. Marcia Keller. I mean, you could just go down the list. Jeff Blodgett worked at Wellstone Alliance and or Wellstone Action. I'm sorry. And then he's doing a bunch of other political consulting.
Was traditional journalism then out then? Once you make the move to work for a candidate, and it's almost like it's partisan, was traditional journalism going back as a reporter out for you, do you think?
I think I probably could have swung it if I was interested, but it just didn't.
It
seemed like I'd already changed course, and then this thing came up at McAllister, which was a good gig for me, you know, doing communications there and teaching a little bit on the side. So I enjoyed those years. You know, it's hard to go back to something like this, as I said earlier. I mean, I'm not sure I could go. I still write. Now I do a blog occasionally for the StarTribune.com,
right.
And I in my work, I have a little thing called Doug Stone Communications where I work, do PR work and communications work, mostly for nonprofits, but I help people write op-eds, and I still work with the media all the time. So I'm kind of seeing it from a different angle. But I respect journalists. Journalists, it's a great profession. I don't think either of my kids is interested in going into it, but if they were, I'd be happy. I still hang out. I have lunch once a month with two different groups. One group from CCO, kind of Nimmer and Hanberg, and another group from my newspaper days, Dean Rebifoni, Steve Dornfeld, Bob Franklin, Steve Berg, Aaron Kahn.
And
from the Pioneer Press.
And some of these guys have wandered over to Min Post and wrote for Min Post occasionally, which is...
I did that for a while, too, myself.
Well, Jay, it's great. That's where our good friend Brian Lambert strikes the glean every day. We got to, you know, push Brian Lambert's column when we can.
Brian's great.
No, Brian's a good guy. He'll have something to say about these things we're talking about on Thursday night.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm going to try to make that, Tom. It sounds like...
No, it'll hopefully be a good show. I'm hoping that the weather doesn't keep people away. We're not supposed to have any blizzards that night. Tom, let's take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk more about Doug. I'm going to talk more about McAllister days and maybe a little bit more about Washington because I want to dig into that a little bit more. Flash at Twin Cities here on KLBB Club 1220. Flash at Twin Cities. Tom Osmond with our guest Doug Stone. Doug has had about four different careers in the last 10 years. I'm not gonna date you too bad here. We're talking off air. We have some good conversations off air. Maybe I'll have to upload those to YouTube sometime. But when you were with Senator Wellstone in the early days, you were there right after maybe a couple publicity errors that that he had did. It was during the Gulf War era. He was very vocally against the Gulf War, which at the time it seemed
this is the first Gulf War.
First Gulf War, 91, right. Kuwait had been invaded. We were headed toward war. He campaigned on an anti-war platform, and then the major publicity error was don't do a press conference from the Vietnam Memorial Wall.
Well, I think that happened just before I got there, Tom. And I think what happened was staff had been told by, I think, the Park Service that it was okay to do it there. And then when they did the news conference, then everyone came out of the woodwork and said, you know, it's really tacky and you shouldn't have done it. And I think everyone realized that later, but they felt like they had been sandbagged.
Mm-hmm.
And I understood that. And by the time, you know, our early days in Washington, like that for most newcomers, was a little rocky. You know, and Paul, a very outspoken and articulate person and was against the war, you know, there were a number of things that happened that he got criticized for. He handed, I think, Dan Quayle a tape, Dan Quayle's vice president then, a tape of some town meetings from Minnesota where people were very much against going to war in the Persian Gulf in 91. Bush was quoted in, I believe, Time magazine as calling him a chicken.
Something,
blank, blank,
right,
blank.
That one.
And that was the Vietnam War Memorial
chicken
thing.
Chicken egg.
A couple other things. And so we got off on a tough footing. I think there was some controversy involving Jesse Helms, the rather conservative Republican from North Carolina. But, you know, at the end of the day, Paul was a great guy and terrific senator. And, you know, I believe if he hadn't died in that crash, he would have been reelected. And he's got a lot of loyal, capable former staff members who are doing some really good things. I didn't mention Sue Abderholden is the head of NAMI, the National Association for Mental Health, I believe, in the Minnesota division. Sarah Stays, the head of Planned Parenthood. I mean, just on and on, just people who are leaders in the community in the same kind of grassroots organizing tradition as Paul Wellstone.
When I see young people, staff of either congressmen or senators, congresspeople, they have the BlackBerry, the iPhones out. They're constantly checking in with every organization, checking back to the office. You were walking around with Senator Wellstone with no digital devices. You were trying to keep him on track without a GPS. Sounds like he might have got wandered around the Capitol a couple times trying to find where his desk was. And you were
We both got lost, so I can't blame that on him. But if you've ever been to the U.S. Capitol building, it's rather confusing in the basement.
I was with a tour guide. I didn't. I just stayed with the tour guide on the, and I didn't wander off the path. I was afraid where I'd end up if I did.
I have trouble finding my way from the Minnesota State Capitol to the state office building. It's only one tunnel. So
I get lost in the staircase here, so I'm in no position to talk. A lot of sleepless nights in Washington. I mean, this is some high-profile stuff, and you're in a town that is not a little intense.
It is a very intense town. It's a young person's town, and I was probably 41 when I was there. Didn't have kids at the time. I don't know about sleepless nights because you work so hard, you're pretty tired.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, Paul was a workout guy. So, you know, we might run. You know, he did weights. I don't know how he slept, but I think I slept pretty good. You know, you worry about stuff. But the thing he had going for him is what I mentioned earlier, is that reporters actually liked him. When I got to Washington, there were, I think, 50 pink slips, you know, message slips for the new press secretary. People who'd called wanted an interview. And that was January. By April, with new calls coming in all the time, I got back to everybody. So that's how crazy it was. I mean, he did interview after interview, and, you know, he went on brief him first, and, you know, you'd sit in on the interview. I mean, you know, a lot of people came over, you know, well-known Washington people. Tom Friedman, it was a reporter then, he came mm-hmm. over and for the New York Times, and Rick Burke did a a New York Times Magazine story on Paul. Rick Berkus was a reporter, then a assistant managing editor at the New York Times, and he just went to Political, and I think he's the executive editor of Political, or editor, executive editor. And Rick was an intern at the Star Tribune when I was a reporter, and he reminded me of that when the tables were kind of turned in Washington when I was the press secretary. So, you know, Rick did a New York Times Magazine story on Paul, which you to kill for, you know. Right, I mean, if you're a politician, that's what you want. And so...
Did it go as planned?
Well, I thought so, but obviously some other people didn't. On a Friday afternoon, Paul was back in Minnesota, and they wanted me to go get the story. So I took a Metro subway over to the New York Times Bureau, and Rick got me an advance copy because it was already printed, coming out on Sunday. So I read it on the way back. I said, well, that's pretty good. And then we faxed it. I couldn't scan back then. We faxed it to Minnesota, and then we just sat around. Whoever was left in the office, we sat around and waited for the
phone call.
Phone call, and they didn't like it. I'm going, oh, I won't say what I said, but I said, well, what's wrong? Well, there were two things that apparently Paul didn't like. One was that the article said he had finally gotten a professional haircut because it's Sheila, his wife, used to cut his hair. So some people interpreted that as a sellout. You know.
He becomes a Washington now. Not
yeah.
These
Which
barbers.
Really wasn't. Someone had who ran a beauty shop or a haircut place in St. Paul said she'd give him a free haircut.
This wasn't the John Edwards haircut we're talking about.
No, okay. It was not. And, you know, he had curly hair kind of like mine, what hair I have left. And, you know, he was Paul, a professor. And the second thing was there was some throwaway sentence in there about how the Capitol security treated him like a lost nephew because he's always getting lost. Well, I was with him. We always got lost in the Capitol.
Sadly, it's endearing, but...
I thought so, and I think maybe years later he probably... But, you know, I told him that, you know, he should... With the media, you have to take the good with the bad. If you want to be in it, you know, and get the coverage, you got to deal with, you know, sometimes they're going to take a shot. In this case, they were pretty gentle shots, I thought. And I had an old reporter friend of my dad's, the late Vic Cohn, who was a science writer for the Star Tribune and then the Washington Post. He had called me and said, wow, it's a great story. You know, he said 99 other senators would die to have that story. So I felt pretty good about it. We had our disagreement. You know, if I could talk to him now about it, he'd probably laugh.
And you gave all that up to come back to Minnesota to go back into the academic world.
Well, yeah, I guess we wanted to move back. Washington sometimes can be a short-term stay. You can't really keep that up. I would have preferred to stay a couple more years, but my family, we wanted to get back to Minnesota. So I got a good job at McAllister for about 15 and two-thirds years.
And your role at McAllister was you were communication, was it director or was it communication?
It was college relations director.
Okay.
But basically communications director. We had staff about 8-9 people. We did, you know, PR, media, publications, speech writing, whatever.
So you're writing for the president and writing for all the, okay.
I worked for 3 different presidents. And in fact, I just had breakfast in Chicago with one of my old bosses, Mike McPherson, who was the president for a number of years. From 98 to mid 2000s or something like that.
And you still teach, or are you pretty?
No, I taught for all the years I was there, and then I taught a couple years after I left a journalism class, which I really enjoyed. But I'm trying to develop this communications business, and it was kind of time consuming.
So, in your current communication business, what kind of things are you doing right now?
I do public relations mostly for nonprofits for a group called Books for Africa, which is in downtown St. Paul. They've shipped about 29 million books to 49 African countries, I think, in the last quarter century. College of Education at the University of Minnesota, I help do videos over there. A thing called the World Press Institute, formerly of McAllister, now based at St. Thomas. I'm called program director. I basically plan their visits, and we take them around the country. And then when they're in St. Paul, they're at St. Thomas. The journalism department there, and Associate Dean Christy Bunton, and really helpful, receptive to that.
And your blog on StarTribune.com still?
Yes. It's called Your Voices. There's like 40 people, so you blog whenever you can get around to it.
Barry Zavan, he has a voice too. We've had him on the show a couple times. Yep. He has a voice out there, and then I've read your blog occasionally. You're not bored.
I'm not bored. I have 2 teenage daughters. I've got one in freshman in college at Monmouth College in Illinois. In fact, I just went down to a swim meet to watch her at Grinnell, which is in Iowa, which is really fun. And then I've got a sophomore at Highland High School.
I can't help notice you have some names on your sheet here, and I'm wondering if there's some stories behind these names here that you could share here with.
I wrote down names because sometimes, you know, when you get to be in your mid-60s, you have a senior moment and you forget names. But I thought you were going to ask me some stuff about CCO, and I just wanted to be prepared to name some of the old people who made it such a special place.
Well, let's see, this one right here, he still pops up once in a while.
Al Austin?
No, Don.
Shelby. Yeah, right. Shelby's around. Yep, Don Shelby's around. I run into Don. He's doing some stuff for Bring Me the News, right?
He's on with Tom Renard. He's on with Rick Coachella. I know that actually in the Tribune, Don Shelby said, I'm not going to be like Dave Moore, and I'm not going to be wandering around the newsroom at, you know, age 65. And now I see Don Shelby more than I did, I think, when he was on the news. He's everywhere.
I think he likes to be out there.
He likes it, too. I see him on TPT fundraisers, and I hear him on the radio. He's everywhere.
You know, people always say, well, how do you compare TV news now to then? You know, it's hard because the technology is so different now. But what I can say about then, and I wouldn't make the statement it was so much better then than it is now. I'm not one of those people because things improve. There's some terrific reporters and producers now, just like there were then. But what stood out for me in my 9 years at CCO was the quality, the professional quality, and also the human quality of the people who worked there. Just a great group of people, you know, from Ron Hanberg to Nimmer, to Dave Moore, of course, you know, and the Caroline Lowe's of the world. Caroline's out in California now. Pat Kessler, you know, Tom Ziegler I mentioned earlier. Just a great group of people.
This is a part of people that listen to this program, you know, more than once in a while, which hopefully many people do, that in this market, and you've been in D.C., you saw that local D.C. market, and I've been in different cities, too, where I've lived. We have a very great news market here, and we have our audience here, whether it be for politicians or for our journalism, we have high standard. We don't put up with a lot of corruption. We also don't put up with you're not gonna see car chases on, you know, local news here for a half hour. You go out to LA, it's celebrity, it's LA, and we're merging that way a little bit, I think, with the way stations. You were owned locally when you were at CCO, and now it's a nationally owned conglomerate, CBS. But I think that, you know, Channel 5, Channel 4, and, you know, Channel 11 eventually, you know, they all had a niche of what they were doing, and they served the audience well. And I'm hoping that that doesn't go away as we continue to, I don't want to use the word erode, but, you know, as things change and as we are faster of the draw, we have to get more out there, more sensationalism, more infotainment, which I think that if you had asked Dave Moore, you know, 30 years ago, he would have said it's never been worse. Well, now let's, you know, take a look at 2014 now. And maybe some people find it better. Some people don't want to be depressed. They don't want to. They don't want to see the grittiness that happens in this town. But,
well, I think you make a number of good points, Tom. I think this is a very sophisticated news market, and it always has been. Compared to, I mean, if you go watch the news in L.A. or even New York or Chicago, I mean, there's a lot more. Well, there is more crime in those towns and more things happening. But I think people care about this community. You know, that's the Twin Cities, and they want to know what's going on and who's making the decisions, and I think that the news stations get that, but at the end of the day they're businesses too, and they want people to watch them. So, you know, if they think that 10 minutes of weather or a car chase is going to help the ratings, they might do that. But I think there are a lot of really responsible editors, news directors, journalists here, you know, who do a good job day in and day out. I can find fault with every news organization and
anywhere,
and television station anywhere, and here's no exception. But I think there's a lot of really good people. I hate when people say the media this or the media that, because it's every organization is different. There's no media does something, and I mean we all fall into that, but that's not the way it is.
Instead, you want about the New York Post? They do a good job of selling papers and putting really entertaining headlines out there. So the New York Post might be not on the highbrow of journalism, but you got to give them this. They do know how to put a headline out there.
Well, that's true. That's true. And New York's a different kind of media market. It's also very competitive. You know, and we still wrestle with ethical issues. I mean, just the other day, I was watching this interview with Bodie Miller, and the interviewer, I can't remember her name, NBC person. You know, she kept pushing about his brother who had died, and he got very emotional, and she kept asking him. You know, and people criticized her, and then he came out the next day, said it was okay. You know, and I guess I felt like you can ask the question once or twice, and then if the guy starts crying, you know, give him a break. He's a human being, you know. And people aren't sitting at home waiting for him to cry more. That's not what they want.
The question I see more nationally than I see locally here is when a major tragedy happens, okay, and the microphone comes to one's face, and the other question they're going to ask you, well, how do you feel about this?
I hate that.
And you see it. I remember after 9/11, seeing this on national programs, and they must have every reporter that had, you know, had any bit of, you know, journalism, you know, background on there. All the interns are probably out there, you know, with the microphone. And I remember at least three times watching someone had, you know, either their family had perished or someone they knew, and they asked that question. And I remember one very emotional young man said, well, how do you think I feel?
Well, good
for
him.
That was the first time I ever actually heard that response back to that question.
It's such an easy question to ask, and yet it's so trite and it's so inappropriate, you know, because your whole family just died. How do you feel? I mean,
it's for the
not
sole express purpose of watching them break down on
exactly,
TV.
Exactly. It's okay to ask that question to the winning quarterback in the Super Bowl. You know, you just won the Super Bowl. How do you feel? I'm going to Disney World, whatever. That's a different thing.
You know, I have to say one thing about politicians in this town is, you know, we've had corruption in politics in this town, and I think we've rid them, and we'll still continue to do. Your friend R.T. Rybak, mayor of Minneapolis, and was a very successful mayor. I remember a few years ago, he published a newsletter from the city of Minneapolis, and his picture was all over it, and the city did not like that. They said, no, you're self-campaigning yourself.
Right.
When I lived in Chicago for a brief period of time, I was amazed by how the politicians in Chicago could self-promote themselves through signs, through actual literature, which was paid for by the city, because they would, you know, the aldermen would put out the suit newsletter with their face over it, you know, cutting ribbons and shaking hands. Minnesota, we just do not, you know, any bit of impropriety, we are there to call politicians out on it. You know, we have politicians we don't agree with, you know, some in Washington, some here locally, but eventually it catches up with them, and eventually any bit of, you know, illegal matters, whether it be the Minneapolis City Council or, you know, we had those scandals 20 years ago in the State House, they go away. We don't put up with it. Other cities, I think they are more tolerant and laugh about it.
I think we have pretty high ethical and professional standards. I mean, as far as the issue you raise about using public monies for campaigns, you know, those things have to be separate. I wish we could get the money out of campaigns altogether. That's a whole other issue.
That could be a whole show. We could discuss that one.
But,
do a debate show.
Exactly.
Well, Doug, I appreciate you coming on the show today. I hope to see you at Newsapalooza this Thursday night. It's going to be fun. We will hopefully be discussing some of these topics on Thursday night. I know that, again, we'll have a cross group of TV, radio, legal, and print and otherwise. We'll be there. And also, we'll be discussing Block E, which has been a major controversy for 30 years, stadiums, that's come up a couple times, weather, sports highlights and lowlights, and I also, you know, some fun commercials I might have found in the archive of tcmedianow.com.
I'm genuinely excited for the blooper reels.
And the blooper reels, I have some bloopers that I've not published online because, you know, once it's on the internet, it's there forever, but I don't mind putting it out in a theater which no one hopefully will be recording with their phones.
And, well, I appreciate you asking me on the radio. When I first went to CCO, they told me, welcome, Doug, you have a great face for radio.
Well,
ouch.
You can see your picture on the Tribune, though. I think I would tend to disagree. We'll be back next Saturday. We have Tom Hauser from Channel 5 on next Saturday, March 1st. March 1st, springtime, right? Okay. Flashback Twin Cities, this is Tom Osmond. Back next week on KLDB Club 1220.